Are you ready for some revolutionary radio? Let's do it together right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, I tweeted it out. I posted it on Facebook last night, just something I was feeling deeply. I never signed up to be part of traditional religion or to be part of the religious right or to be part of the mainstream establishment. I signed up to be a disciple and to make disciples. And sometimes that intersects with traditional religion and the religious right and the mainstream establishment. Sometimes it goes directly against it. And that's why we keep talking about revolution. Welcome to the broadcast. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884, the number to call. I have a question for you. Did you watch the interview on Tucker Carlson last night? I guess his first show now, taking over for the slot for Bill O'Reilly, where he interviewed Bruce Caitlin Jenner. Did you watch the interview either live or subsequently? If so, in your opinion, did it help the cause of transgender activism? Here you have Bruce Jenner talking about the struggles he's endured and the struggles of those who identify as transgender. And sexuality is one thing and gender identity is another, and therefore discussing it in this way is only going to help the cause of trans activists? Or do you feel that it hurt the cause of transgender activists in that you have someone that is still evidently a biological male, even with sex change surgery, doesn't change that Bruce Jenner is a biological chromosomal male? And talking with, if you turn away from the screen, that's a male voice, and not able to answer certain questions head on, or choosing not to answer them head on. In that case, did it hurt the cause of trans activism? Just curious. We're not going to major on that. May take a few calls. But if you watched the interview, if you saw it last night, and you have an opinion, let me know. I also posted the question on Twitter and Facebook, so you can weigh in there as well. 866-348-7884. We're going to bring on, a little while into the broadcast, in the first hour, John Zmirak. John is a friend and colleague. He writes regularly on the stream as well as PhD in English literature. He is a conservative Catholic, and he has lots of concerns with where Catholic bishops are going and lots of concerns with where Pope Francis is going. So since I'm not Catholic and since I don't major on Catholic issues, but they are of national interest and international interest, and because John is a conservative Catholic, I think you'll find his perspective very interesting. John's always got brilliant, insightful perspectives as well. We'll get into that. Someone just sent me, I didn't hear about this. A new family arrangement. Yeah, a bit of a shocker. Oh, but everyone's going to be so happy. We'll tell you about that as well. Maybe get into some of the errors where science ceases to be science, where in the name of science it gets involved in bizarre issues and claims. Hopefully we'll get to that as well. A bunch more things. And your calls, 866-348-7884. But first, I want to talk about what fuels my fire. I want to talk about why I said that I never signed up for traditional religion. I had a radical encounter with God over 45 years ago, and since then I've lived to make him known. Jesus revolutionized my life, and I want to help spread that revolution around the world. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. My latest article, you can read it by going to my website, askdrbrown.org. It's drawing a good amount of attention. And actually, hang on, you read it at the Charisma News site. That looks like where it is. You can read it on the Charisma News site. And that might be the easiest place to read it right now. Low-cut tops, sexual harassment, and Bill O'Reilly. Low-cut tops, sexual harassment, and Bill O'Reilly. I think you'll find it interesting, and I'm eager to start reading the responses and comments. Let me just see. Yeah, I haven't even looked at the comments yet, but I'm eager to check that out as well. We talked about it on the air yesterday, and I'm not revisiting that today. Just want to let you know that, as promised, I did write the article. Okay. All right. What did I mean when I said I didn't sign up for traditional religion? What prompted me to post that? What's that got to do with you? Why do you care what I did or didn't sign up for it? Let me explain. I was looking at some footage last night on YouTube, looking at some remakes of classic songs, folk songs, rock songs that got redone by others. I forget what got me on that subject. There's apparently a heavy metal group or something. I'm not familiar with them, Disturbed. And they put out a very powerful rendition of the Simon Garfunkel Sound of Silence song. Apparently that's become a big hit. I'm not familiar with the group, just knew the song from many years ago. And there was the famous Jimi Hendrix remake of the Bob Dylan All Along the Watchtower. Of course, that was in the 60s. And I was just looking at some of these, and it drew me to some footage from Woodstock. There was a song that Joni Mitchell wrote about Woodstock. She wasn't there. And Crosby, Stills, and Nash then did their rendition of it. Theirs was kind of a cheery, upbeat. The Joni Mitchell one more of kind of like a, almost like a hymn to Woodstock. And the Crosby, Stills, and Nash, this kind of cheery one. And it's often played with footage from Woodstock and, oh, what a day and what an era and all of that. Now, of course, in short, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, if you want to reduce it to what actually happened. And, in fact, the counterculture revolution of the 60s helped pave the way for a lot of the problems we're experiencing today. And many of the radicals from the 60s are now tenured professors at our universities, but they're just as radical as ever. So in that regard, a lot of bad came out of that time. There's the old saying, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. And some of you are nodding because you were there and you understand exactly what it means. On the other hand, there was a spiritual search going on. There was a cry. There was a recognition that the world as we knew it was messed up and that change needed to come. There was a recognition that the world as we knew it was not making sense. Daddy, why do you tell me I need to study hard in school? Son, you need to do well in school so that you can get accepted to the best college. Daddy, why do I want to get accepted to the best college? Son, you want to get accepted to the best college so that you can get the best education and get the best job. Daddy, why do I need the best job? You need the best job so that you can put your kids in the best school and give them the best education so they can get the best job, so they can put their kids in the best school and give them the best education. And young people say, wait, wait, that's it? That's the meaning of life? That's the American dream? Now, again, I'm oversimplifying, but people began to ask more questions about the meaning of life. And then young people, young men, faced with the prospect of a draft and having to go fight in Vietnam for a war that seemed to make no sense at all. Why that? Why are we going? Why are we dying there? we're coming back and we're rejected by our own country. There was a pushback against the establishment, and just sociologically, demographically, the baby boomer generation, so the post-war years, now couples having children, and now a larger percentage of children being born, so you have a larger percentage of young people, and young people tend to fight more and be anti-establishment more and challenge the rules more. So you have that happening in disproportionate measure relative to our normal societal breakdown. You have all of the ingredients for cultural change. Which way is it going to go? Psychologist David Myers, in a book written about 15 years ago, pointed out if you fell asleep in the year 1960 and woke up in the year 2000, you'd wake up to the divorce rate doubled, teen suicide tripled, reported violent crime up 4 times, prison population up 5 times, children born out of wedlock up 6 times, people living together out of wedlock up 7 times. Dramatic shifts. Good things happened in the 60s for sure. Things like the civil rights movement and certain aspects of women's equality, positive. But there was also radical feminism that downplayed the importance and sacredness of motherhood. There was the strong pro-abortion movement. There was the sexual revolution. There was the introduction of marijuana and psychedelic drugs. There was the introduction of Eastern religion. There was the birthing in force of the gay rights movement. A lot of these things were birthed out of the 60s and have had a negative, destructive effect on our society. You say, okay, I still don't get where you're going with all this, and what does this have to do with traditional religion? Okay. I was part of that 60s counterculture revolution and anti-establishment and again, the whole just drugs and rock and roll and decadent lifestyle. But when Jesus saved me, I realized, okay, this is what life is all about. It was not about traditional religion, and I don't mean religion can't have tradition. A Catholic woman started going back and forth with me on Twitter. I said, I'm not thinking Catholicism. That wasn't my issue. I wasn't thinking traditional Judaism when I said it. I was thinking within the context of traditional Protestant religion, okay, in terms of the context of the circles in which I traveled primarily. I wasn't thinking about Orthodox churches or traditional Jewish synagogues or Catholic churches. I wasn't even thinking about that. It's not that you can't have beauty in tradition, but the traditional religion to me is the religion of the establishment. Traditional religion is the religion of the status quo. That's what I meant by it. And when I watched that old footage from Woodstock, yes, people were lost. Yes, it was decadent and people sleeping together didn't even know each other for 24 hours and all kinds of drug use. Yes, yes, yes. And a lot of the message that was coming forth in the music was anything but wholesome. I understand all of that. I'm not glorifying it. I'm not changing what it was. I am saying that people were searching. There was a spiritual search. There was a recognition that this material world alone is not it. There was a recognition that there had to be more. And for the most part, the church was asleep through a lot of what was happening and didn't realize what was taking place. What the church saw primarily in those days was, this is just rebellion, this is the end times, this is it, the whole world's going to hell, look around, look at what's happening. Rather than saying, okay, a lot of sinful things are happening, it's a lot of rebellion, no question about it, but people are looking, people are searching. And a lot of young people knew the one place you don't search is the church, because that's traditional religion. That's why you go to the Eastern religions or this ideology or that ideology. And of course, God graciously, wonderfully, gloriously did save many of us in traditional church buildings with stained glass windows and pews, and saved many of us in that setting. And in some settings where the leader wore a clerical outfit and others where they just wore a suit and tie, but I'm talking about it wasn't a hippie fest. They weren't playing Jimi Hendrix music and smoking pot and talking about Jesus. We got saved in traditional churches in that respect. But what has driven me all these years is not, we must reestablish the status quo and enforce that on society. No, that's never resonated with me. It's not right-wing politics that resonates with me. What resonates with me is the revolutionary cause of Jesus. This is what so many young people are really looking for, and that's why when they found him, they found the meaning of life. The ultimate one who came to challenge the establishment. The ultimate one who came to challenge the ways of man and the ways of the flesh. The ultimate one who said, there is something more. He's the one I relate to. I don't relate to right-wing politics. I don't relate to traditional religion. I relate to the revolutionary cause of Jesus. And in many cases, it's very different than what mainstream religion gives itself to. How revolutionary do we want to be in terms of how much do we really want to follow Jesus? We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, I hope you hear what I'm saying. I joyfully, gladly work with believers from every background. And if the person I'm working with wears a robe or wears a clerical collar or wears a suit and tie or wears a t-shirt, that's immaterial to me. If they love the Lord, if they're devoted to Jesus, if they're serious about serving God, I could care less about that. And I could care less about the tag that they put on themselves, whether they say we're part of the radical underground church or we're part of the Orthodox establishment. I could care less about the tag. I want to know exactly what do you believe according to the Bible, what do you believe, and how do you live? That's my issue. And I recognize that there is much that is holy and beautiful in tradition. I recognize that God has preserved truths in his word and among his people, meaning I have no problem with one church group saying we base ourselves on this particular creed or confession because we find it to be in harmony with scripture and sacred. Fine. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every generation. I'm not saying that. And I am pro-authority. I don't know how you could be pro-God and anti-authority, because God is a God of order and authority. And when we get out of authority, then we have chaos and anarchy. And rebellion is wrong. I know it was a slogan in the American Revolution that rebellion against tyrants is obedience to God. But I want to emphasize obedience to God. I want to emphasize that's what matters, obedience to God. I'm not out to rebel against the system. I'm not out to rebel against the society. I'm out to obey God. But often we have this traditional religious way of doing it. We could do it in a house group where everyone's sitting around, you know, drinking soda and with wearing sandals and jeans and, oh, we're non-traditional. Like, it'd be totally traditional. The forum is not as important to me as the spirit of the thing. And what I do not resonate with is status quo religion. What I do not resonate with is just the old way of doing it. We're just going to impose that without vitality and life. The old truths, yes, the old ways of God, they never change. But today, that is totally revolutionary. To live by the ways of God today is totally revolutionary. To live by biblical principles is totally revolutionary. And that's what my heart beats with. A Jesus revolution, meaning he radically changes us and we go and change our world. That the effect of God's presence, God's truth, God's spirit in our lives, the effect of the death and resurrection of Jesus in our lives is so dramatic that it causes us to bow down to different gods, that it causes us to live for different purposes, that we live with eternity in mind, passing through this world, whether we have a big house or a small house, whether we have money in the bank or not, that's all secondary. It's the attitude of the heart which is the biggest. And we are here to bring about change. That as we're raising our kids, we're here to raise kids that are not just going to live by the the status quo of the society or march to the beat of the same drummer. We want them to march to the drumbeat of our God, of our King, of our Savior, of our Lord. We want to raise up kids that in turn are going to be counterculture revolutionaries for Jesus by going against the tide of the society, by going against the grain of the society, by going against the status quo of the world, be it the values of the world, be it the lifestyle of the world, be it the practices of the world, where those are contrary to the ways of God, then that's when we stand up and say, we are going to do what is right, and we are going to swim against the tide, and we are going to go against the grain, and we are going to sensitize our minds, our hearts to the things that Jesus cares about. And if that means wearing tie-dye shirts, or whether that means wearing suits and ties and long dresses, that part is immaterial. But the idea that all that we're here to do is impose traditional religious values on society, I don't resonate with that. I don't resonate with that. In fact, I don't like to use the term traditional marriage. We stand for traditional marriage. Now, please, many of my friends and colleagues use that term, and I understand exactly what they mean. But I'm not fighting for traditional marriage. What if our traditions were wrong? What if we lived in Uganda where traditional marriage included polygamy? Even in the church settings, that's not the goal. What if traditional marriage was a completely patriarchal thing where the man was over the woman and she was like a slave and more like a possession? What if that was traditional marriage? That's not what I want. That's not the goal. The goal is marriage as God intended it. The goal is family as God intended it. The goal is truth as God defines it. Not the subjective definitions of this age, not your truth and my truth, but the truth. That's the goal. And again, many times it's just semantics, but a lot of times it is how we live. It is how we relate to this world. And I relate to this world in a revolutionary way. The same way that I was in sin and thinking, hey, this is what I'm living for now, and drugs and rock and roll and this whole lifestyle and gave myself to it. I was wrong. It was demonic. I was deluded. Well, I met the Lord. Well, then I gave myself to Him all the way, not partially, not half-heartedly, but all the way. And I remember as a fairly new believer, my life was clean for the first time. And now I'm living for God. But I'm not totally filled with God in that I've gotten rid of the bad, but I haven't totally filled myself with the new, with the good, with God. And I remember I said to myself, I could live a clean but empty life, or I could give myself to God the way I gave myself to drugs and rock music. And with that, I took the plunge. And with that, spent hours and hours with the Lord in the Word and prayer. And my life was revolutionized even yet more radically. That's what I'm appealing to you to do, to give yourself to God the way in the past you gave yourself to sin, or the way you gave yourself to sports or music or making money or whatever it was to get ahead, and you gave yourself with great dedication and sacrifice. Give yourself to God that way and then say, Lord, here I am. Send me. Use me. Friend, I want to encourage you to visit our website, AskDrBrown.org. When you do, make sure you sign up for my emails, my weekly emails, which will bless you and encourage you and equip you and help you. I want to send you a free ebook, 7 Secrets of the Real Messiah. I'm telling you, this is an eye-opener. It's my gift to you. When you sign up for our emails, go to AskDrBrown.org. Today, we come back speaking to John Zmarek. It's going to be another interesting conversation.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the line of fire, 866-348-7884. It is my delight to speak with friend and colleague John Zmirak. He writes regularly as a senior editor with the Stream, stream.org. I'm always learning from his articles and finding them thoroughly enjoyable as well. We've got a bunch of things to talk about today. Hey, John, thanks for joining us again on the line of fire.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
Let's talk briefly about France. And then, with you being a conservative Catholic, I really want to hear your view on Pope Francis and then bishops, Catholic bishops in America. It's a world that's a little different than my world, and I'm eager to hear your perspective on it. But, John, I wrote an article just with one focus about the Jewish people of France and Marine Le Pen, and raised that one side of the issue only. You're looking at the broader issues of what France is facing and the two candidates that it could potentially vote for. So what do you see as the strengths and weaknesses of the candidates? What can we learn from French history in the past?
Well, you know, I agree with you on what you wrote about Le Pen's views on Jewish issues in France. And I had previously said I think it's disastrous that she wants to say that you can't have dual citizenship with Israel. I think that Jews are a special case, especially in France, where French Jews whose ancestors had lived in the country for hundreds of years were targeted by the French government in cooperation with the Nazis within living memory. I think that alone ought to merit French Jews an exception from her otherwise admirable policy of opposing dual citizenship. And I agree about religious garb. There should be no restriction on Jews wearing religious garb in France in any way. Apart from that, I think she has a sound, solid set of policies that are needed in the state of emergency that the nation of France has entered because of a reckless policy of importing millions of radical Muslim immigrants to do low-wage jobs, but a lot of them just to be on public assistance because France doesn't have a lot of low-wage jobs. They have whole neighborhoods that are no-go zones, not just for women who don't, there are videos of Western journalists trying to go into parts of Paris not wearing a headscarf and being stopped and yelled at by Arab men in the street. This is happening in the capital of France. Imagine that happening in Georgetown.
Mm.
That's what's happening in France. And the casualties from terrorist attacks, all of them Muslim, all of them, have gone from the dozens to the hundreds every year in France. They're killing priests at the altar as they say mass. There is no the presence of all these people in France serves no economic purpose. They're not integrating into the country. A lot of them are not loyal to the country. They really have no place in the country. And it ought to be the policy of the government of France to try to get as many of them as possible to go home where they belong.
Got it. So Marine Le Pen is obviously the candidate for that, saying that extremist mosques would be shut down and people deported for those kind of activities. Do you think that she is unfairly being categorized as extreme right?
Yeah, I think so. I think the same way people try to portray Donald Trump as a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist, simply because he didn't follow the prescribed talking points of multiculturalism and the far cultural left. We see how viciously intolerant the left is of dissent on campus. You know, they tried to label the distinguished professor Charles Murray as a white supremacist based on zero evidence. I think it probably is safe, unless you have strong evidence to the contrary. When you hear someone called a white supremacist or a racist, assume it's a lie. Mm. Now, sometimes it will be true. You and I were on Twitter and encountered some people who really did turn out to be nasty white supremacist cranks. They exist, but they're pretty rare.
Yeah, what's interesting was that one guy said, look, I don't want to be a racist and my family doesn't like the way I'm going, but America needs to be white. All right, we'll be right back with John Zmirak. Don't go anywhere.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. Speaking with my friend and colleague, John Zmirak. To read John's most recent articles, go to stream.org. You can read mine there as well. John, I mentioned over the weekend that somehow I didn't spot an article that you wrote a few weeks back asking ladies who they'd rather be married to, Anthony Weiner or Mike Pence. But I thought that just the title alone said it all, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, actually, if you look at the article, it all started with I created a Twitter poll. Who would you rather men be more like? Mike Pence, Anthony Weiner, Bill Clinton, or Bruce Jenner?
Yeah.
And I think those are the four choices that are really on the table for men. And I can explain that. You can be like Mike Pence and acknowledge the power of male sexuality, which is different from female sexuality. It's fallen, so is female sexuality. But still, there are traces of the divine plan there. We need to control them with the power of grace and with virtuous habits and intelligent management, just as we control other appetites. You just did a book on food. I wish I had better control over that. We need to control our appetites, but especially in the area of sex, where the object of the appetite is not a chicken leg. It's a human being with a soul and feelings. Mm. And the product of it is not, you know, that you need to go to the bathroom. It's a human being that will live for 7 years and have a soul for eternity. So it's obvious why sex is not just another ordinary bodily appetite. But the sexual revolution taught us to pretend that it is, like scratching an itch. The results of the sexual revolution were so devastating to women, they created feminism as a kind of pseudo-puritanical backlash against male sexuality. Nobody wants to look at the old solutions, the traditional solutions, of channeling sexuality exclusively through marriage that is oriented towards the rearing and Christian education of children. So Mike Pence was mocked throughout the media because he doesn't put himself in occasions of sin. He follows the Billy Graham rule of not getting drunk with women who aren't his wife. Go figure. That is such a crazy, bizarre thing.
Crazy,
not
man,
to get drunk, just... right? And yeah. And men who don't do that, men like Ted Cruz who do socialize, they get falsely smeared as committing adultery. Remember that National Enquirer story that falsely accused him of having affairs? So you cannot win for losing, you know? So you can control your sexuality and channel it in the sacrament of marriage, like Mike Pence. You can be like Bill Clinton and have an arrangement with your wife where you get to sexually exploit weak women, poor women, women who are easily impressed, and your wife tolerates it and helps you cover it up in return for favors. The whole Paula Jones thing and Monica Lewinsky thing was the Hillary not divorcing him over that. The price for that was Bill made her senator from the state of New York. There's a great film, Clinton Inc., that documents that. So the price of Hillary enduring his affairs and actually cooperating in blackening the names of his accusers, including a woman who accused him of forcible rape, the price was political favor. So you could have that arrangement. Or you can have an arrangement like Anthony Weiner, where you're married to a young, beautiful woman, and you can't keep your eyes on her because you're going down the squalid byways of internet filth, and you get addicted to online sex. Or you can be like Bruce Jenner. You can follow what the feminists want and beat and try to hammer your masculinity out of existence. The feminists love Bruce Jenner because they hate masculinity. They hate the healthy, strong, courageous masculinity that God created in Adam, and they want to see it destroyed because they're under the spell of the enemy, who hates every aspect of God's creation, but especially human beings.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, loud and clear in terms of the stark choices and the differences and the question of ladies listening, who would you rather be married to? Yeah, loud and clear, John. All right, so we shift gears here. And you're a conservative Catholic. You've written for Catholic audiences as well as for general audiences. explain first, from your perspective, what the role of the Pope is supposed to be in the Catholic Church, and then how you see Pope Francis lining up in terms of what his role is supposed to be and what he's doing.
Sure. And if anybody wants my more developed views, I have a new book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism, which goes into great depth and documents all of the things I'm about to say. But I've written 9 Catholic books, so I'm pretty well versed in this. The role of the Pope is supposed to be like the role of the U.S. Supreme Court, as a last final arbiter of disputes. The person who, when a dispute about theology has gone through all the scholars and the pastors and the bishops, and it's open to debate, and it's important that it be resolved, there has to be a court of last appeal. The Pope is supposed to be like the Supreme Court, which very, very rarely steps in to interpret the Constitution. Well, the Pope, along with the bishops, are meant to do the same thing for sacred scripture and church tradition. It's supposed to happen. The Pope's ultimate authority, which is considered infallible, is only exercised very rarely. According to scholars, the Pope has only ever used his infallible level of authority 8 times in the whole history of the church. Everything else the Pope does is open to criticism and debate and interpretation. And this Pope has never invoked his highest authority, so we're perfectly free to criticize and judge and treat as 100% human, not divinely authorized, everything the Pope says. And it's a good thing, because this Pope has been spouting nonsense since he got into office.
All right, so as an outsider, in terms of a non-Catholic, I would perceive criticism of the Pope as being un-Catholic or unloyal, but you're saying that's absolutely not the case at all.
Right. It's like you and I can criticize the U.S. government, and it doesn't make us un-American. It's not an act of treason. The only thing that's an act of treason is where you advocate the violent overthrow of the United States government, or you work with an enemy of our country in time of war. Likewise, criticizing statements of the Pope that are made when he's not invoking his ultimate authority, that's perfectly fair game. So don't fall for the idea that the Pope is like Joseph Stalin, and whatever he says at breakfast that morning, we all have to change our minds and believe it. That has never been true. We've had really bad popes. The Catholic Church admits we've had popes who were adulterers. We've had popes who were criminals, who were murderers. We've had popes even who personally held heretical, un-Catholic views and talked about them in public and had to be corrected by other bishops. The only thing we affirm is that on the rare occasions, 8 times in 2,000 years, when the Pope invokes his ultimate authority, we say, well, you know what? Somebody's got to settle the question. It can't be open to debate forever. We believe that Christ gave St. Peter and his successors this ultimate authority to be used on very, very rare occasions, as it has been throughout history.
Got it. So as a non-Catholic, I'd say, well, I disagree with the Pope having that authority, or I disagree with him being infallible ever, or something like that. And that would be obviously understood with me as a non-Catholic. But within the Catholic Church, you could be a loyal Catholic and you could say, I disagree with the Pope. I think he's doing a lousy job. And in fact, the more loyal Catholic you are, the more you might speak out against a Pope who deviated from what you understood was the historic view of the Church. So in that regard... And we got a couple minutes here, and then we'll come back on the other side of the break and talk about American bishops. But if you had to give your list of the worst things that Pope Francis has said or done, what's at the top of your list?
Well, he is confusing Catholic teaching on marriage. The Catholic Church has always believed that divorce and remarriage are impossible because that's how we interpret Jesus' words in the New Testament. And because divorce and remarriage are impossible, people who have a sacramental Catholic marriage and get divorced, and they get remarried outside the church in a civil marriage or non-Catholic marriage, we don't give them Holy Communion because we consider that they're committing adultery. And we don't give communion to people who have unrepented serious sin. The Pope is changing that. He is now saying in 100 different ways that people who are divorced and remarried can receive Holy Communion. Now, that might not sound that odd to Protestants, but that is a core teaching of the church that has been taught infallibly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The Pope is speaking as a private citizen, contradicting previous infallible teaching of the church. So that's a major problem. Politically, he has virtually endorsed socialism, which was condemned by 8 separate popes ever since the late 19th century. Popes over and over again have condemned socialism because it violates private property rights. It results in tyranny. It destroys the family. It tries to replace Christianity. And this pope seems to like it.
Got it. All right. Very loud and clear from John Zmierak. His book, Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us. My great delight to talk to my friend and colleague, John Zmierak. Read his latest articles on the stream, stream.org, be it French elections, be it Donald Trump, things happening in America, moral, cultural issues, or specifically Catholic issues. John is a great guide to go to. All right, the bishops in America, Catholic bishops in America. Obviously, we don't hear about them as much as we hear about perhaps the latest controversial statement that the Pope has made. But what's happening with American Catholic bishops? How monolithic are they? What's your take?
Well, on the issue that's most important, they're actually with Pope Francis. Most U.S. Catholic bishops and Pope Francis, the things they are saying on the topic of immigration are actually at odds with what the Church officially teaches. If you read the Catechism of the Catholic Church and the short section on immigration, it says that countries have a right to control their borders, that they should accept needy immigrants, but only if those immigrants obey the law, respect the culture, pay taxes, and basically assimilate. It's very reasonable. It's a lot like the Republican platform of 2016 that Donald Trump approved. Mm. That is the official teaching of the church. That's what's binding on Catholics. Anything else is hot air and smoke. But there's a lot of hot air and a lot of smoke coming from the Pope and the bishops, but they are speaking out of turn, and we have absolutely no obligation to listen to them. In fact, because they're violating the catechism, we have an obligation to contradict them and fight them. What Pope Francis basically regards any restriction on immigration as a crime against the poor. He has said the most outrageous, insane, moralistic things. In 2013, he said that people who don't want to accept all the immigrants to Europe that want to come from Africa, he compared them to Cain murdering Abel and Herod butchering the infants of Bethlehem.
Mm.
Just this past weekend, on Holocaust Remembrance Day, when they stop everything in Israel for 5 solid minutes and blow air raid sirens to remind people of the horrendous tragedy that happened to the Jews of Europe, on that day, Pope Francis chose to say that the transit camps where Europe is holding would-be refugees and trying to evaluate whether or not they really are refugees or just economic migrants, he described them as concentration camps. Now, that's just obscene. Mm. Jewish leaders actually called on him to apologize for that, to compare what Italy does with African migrants to what the Nazis did to the Jews. That is just, it's stupid. It's morally insensitive. It's false. It's just the kind of hysterical rhetoric we expect from George Soros and the organizations he funds. And on the issue of immigration, Pope Francis is sounding like George Soros in a white cassock.
So why is it that here you are as a Catholic, you're not a priest, you're not a bishop, a cardinal, or a pope, and yet you are holding the pope's feet and the bishop's feet to the fire? Why aren't they not being loyal Catholics? Why this push towards a liberalism?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is a kind of a sentimental false compassion, which says that whenever there's a dispute, the person with less money is always right. They actually came up with a fancy name for that. They call it the preferential option for the poor. But basically it means that you disregard the issue of justice, and you always side with the underdog, even if the underdog happens to be wrong. You know, like, by that logic, anyone who shoplifts at Neiman Marcus is right, because he's got less money than the owner of Neiman Marcus. That kind of just dumb, cheap moralism has infected Catholic circles. Also, and it's important to remember this, in an American context, U.S. Catholic bishops rely on massive immigration from Latin America to keep the Catholic Church from shrinking. Currently, according to the Pew Research Study, 40%, 4 out of 10 people who grow up Catholic in America formally leave and join another church or join no church. That's what a good job our bishops are doing at evangelizing or even preserving the church that they were given the leadership of. Why is it that the Catholic Church is not shrinking the way the Episcopal Church and the Methodist churches are shrinking? Only because of immigration from Latin America. Because the bishops in Latin America do a pretty good job of passing on the faith. So what we're doing is sucking Catholics north to our bad churches, where they then leave the church. I'm sure there are a lot of people in your Protestant congregations who came from Latin America, used to be Catholic, and are now evangelical Protestants, because the Catholic Church in America is so weak, so confused, so riddled with theological liberalism that people up and leave. Instead of fixing the problem, the bishops are covering it up by bringing in more people. It's kind of reminds you of the generals in World War I. They didn't have good tactics. They didn't know how to fight the war. So they just kept throwing more people into the trenches, trying to win the war through sheer numbers. I've actually called it theological cannon fodder. They're treating these immigrants as cannon fodder. And if they really believe it's important these immigrants stay Catholic, then they ought to leave them in Mexico, where they will stay Catholic, because when they come here, they leave.
Very interesting. And yeah, I just wonder how many people have even thought about the issues as to why, or immigration, or people coming to the churches. So where does that leave you, John, as a loyal Catholic, watching some of this large sea change in front of you? Does that make you go in a more traditional way? Where does it bring you personally?
Well, it means I'm probably never going to get a job working for any Catholic organization or institution again, because I've just been too outspoken about this. I mean, there have been times when I said, okay, well, this one's a deal breaker. This means I won't work here and here. And now this article means I won't work there and there. So basically, I thank God I'm working for James Robison and not some Catholic institution that trembles at the idea that they're contradicting the Pope's personal opinion, even when the Pope is going against official Catholic teaching.
And what role does Scripture have in your life in terms of sorting out some of these issues?
Well, it's the ultimate touchstone of every Christian teaching, right? I don't presume to make my personal interpretation of the Scripture decisive. I look back to 2,000 years of what wiser Christians than I, Augustine, Aquinas, all the saints, how they have read Scripture. And so the Catholic mode of reading Scripture is in that historical context. So I'm basically holding fast to the Catholic Church as I learned, to the Catholic faith as I learned it as a child, which was in that historical way, which showed respect for the traditional interpretations of things. And it's not that we respect human traditions as such. We defer to wisdom of generations of saints, the people who evangelized the world. So the way they read the Bible is probably more likely to be right than the way I happen to be reading it now in my modern context. And that deferring to the weight of Christian tradition is one of the most important ways that we don't give in to the fashions of the moment. And so we don't end up like Tony Campolo, just reading the Bible the way the liberals would like us to.
Got it. Hey, John, we're out of time, but great talking to you always. It's always enlightening. And thanks for the Catholic perspective today. God bless you.
God bless.
Are you ready for some revolutionary radio? Let's do it together right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Oh, come on. This is so sweet. Wow. What a great looking family. I'm looking at the picture here. Neat. There's the dad and the mom and the three kids. They're all smart. But wait, hang on. Dad and there's two ladies. Dad and two ladies, three kids, and they're all smiling. What's happening here? Oh, it's a great new happy poly family, and we should all be thrilled with it, right? Hey, friends, welcome to the broadcast. This is Michael Brown. You're listening to The Line of Fire. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-348-7884. I want to talk about some things happening in the church today. And in the second half of this hour, we're going to be joined by a scientist from the Discovery Institute, and that's going to be a fascinating conversation. But first, was just sent this story earlier today. Someone tweeted it to me. Happily married couple who share a girlfriend reveal they are divorcing after 12 years so that one of them can marry her and give her legal rights to their three children. Christina and Benno Kaiser from Austin, Texas, are parents to three children, Isaiah, Rebecca, and Brianna. Christina, who is bisexual, also introduced Sierra, she's just 21, into their relationship. The poly triad family are now planning to officially marry her into the family. But they haven't decided, will Benno, the husband, marry her? Or will Christina, the wife, marry her so it'll be a wife and wife? And isn't this delightful? A couple who's been married for 12 years and have three children together are getting divorced so that their girlfriend won't get jealous. Hey, love is love. Love wins. Why not? You have the right to marry the one you love. And aren't two moms better than one mom? And here you have all kinds of combinations with built-in babysitters and all of that stuff, and now the kids get more attention. God have mercy. God have mercy. These three kids, innocent kids, being raised now to think this is perfectly normal to have two mommies, perfectly normal to have three different people sleeping together in all kinds of different arrangements, all perfectly normal. Now divorce one, bring the other in so that they can have rights to the kids. Oh boy. Yeah. Takes a village to raise a child. Talk about it, taking it to a new level. The benefits of one of us marrying her are going to be on many different levels. She's going to be legally considered a parent to the children. More importantly, we'll show her that this is not a temporary thing. We both love her, and it's not something, and it's something that's meant to be permanent. Wow. And listen, if you have an argument with this being wrong, but you're telling me it's still fine for two men or two women to marry, on what basis? On what basis? This is the inevitable slide that we have talked about for years. Here it is right in front of our eyes. And if you're going to tell me this is wrong, but then tell me it's still fine as long as the number is two, what makes two so magical? The reason for two is because one man and one woman uniquely come together and biologically and every other way can produce what only a man and woman together can produce. This is not a family. This is chaos. We'll be right back.
Hear our cry, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34. Truth is the number to call. Let me restate something. When I said this is not a family, this is chaos, yeah, I understand it's a family. It's not a family as God intended it. And let's just see how long it lasts. As an aside, let's just see how long it lasts. You bring this new gal in, you don't want to have jealousy, so you're, quote, three of you married. Let's just see where this family is in 10 years. I don't wish evil on them. I wish for them to come to know the Lord and find repentance and new life. That's what I wish for them. But we shall see where this goes. Okay, I did not watch Tucker Carlson in the news slot. That would have been Bill O'Reilly's slot. I only don't watch TV news. I'll read stuff the next day, or I'll look at YouTube clips from specific segments. Nothing against it. I just don't normally watch. So it's not like I watched O'Reilly, didn't watch Tucker Carlson, but just didn't watch, period. Anyway, he interviewed Bruce Caitlin Jenner. And my question was, did this help or hurt trans activism? In other words, does this further normalize things? Does this make you say, okay, great, fine, transgender is the new norm, transgender is the new black? Or did this make you say, boy, this just seeing Bruce Jenner there as Caitlyn reminds me again of how wrong this is? So I posted the question on Facebook. Here's some of the responses. Ben, it was very revealing when Mr. Jenner refused to answer Tucker's question about the obvious physical advantage of a male, trans to woman, wrestler has when wrestling women. Ryan, the part where I get kind of confused is how Jenner can say he feels like a woman without prior knowledge as to what it feels like to be a woman. He would have to know what it means to be a woman in order to identify with that. Right? So his perception of what it means to be a woman is what he identifies with. Lynn, absolutely absurd him commenting he's a conservative. Aha, aha. The point is nothing will help the trans movement because it's mental illness pushed by a former president. People know this. Just reading opinions here. Doug, Bruce is incapable of transparency. The level of deception intertwined in the LGBTQ community and lifestyle makes it impossible to be honest, transparent. Ironic, because most homosexuals, transgenders believe the deeper they go into the lifestyle, the more they're being their authentic self. Since acting on same-sex temptation or transgender confusion involves selfishness, pride, and vanity, narcissism, it's impossible for authenticity, truth, or transparency to inhabit those behaviors. I watched about 3 minutes of Tucker's interview with Bruce, then I had to turn it off. It just felt like an effort to normalize transgenderism and an hour-long advertisement for Bruce's vanity project. Patty, no, I'm very disappointed with Tucker Carlson having him on the show. He should not be given any credibility as a serious mental illness. Jennifer, the only thing that's going to help is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Wow. Judy, I just couldn't bear to watch that segment. Sad and mixed up. Jenner, Sharon, no, I did not. As soon as he came on, I turned the channel both times it was on. Pachenko, I don't have an opinion about Caitlyn Jenner. She doesn't matter to me. AJ, yes, the gospel, amen. Bruce is not a woman. Gary, the country is hitting rock bottom to allow that on TV. Carol would never watch Bruce Jenner. Gary was a waste of time, of airtime, disgusting. Sherry, hurt. It's sad to watch, so sad to watch. Ed, I feel sorry for Bruce. Wheeler, I guess Carlson no longer beats up the gays. Wheeler coming from a very liberal perspective there. I didn't know he ever did beat up gays, by the way. On the air. I know he raised honest questions about issues. Well, let's just say from that little cross section of extremely conservative, primarily conservative, Christian-based responders, obviously the vast majority don't think that it helped the cause. Now, Tucker Carlson has all kinds of people on, and he will interview and have that little got a whimsical look on his face as someone saying something pretty crazy and absurd. And I always find that interesting as I've watched those clips. And he'll often press the point. So, again, we'll see. Obviously, it was for ratings to have him on. And Bruce Jenner's got a new book coming out. So, obviously, he's doing the interview route. we shall see which way Tucker Carlson goes in the days ahead and what his views are and what Fox promotes. But I'm not looking to Fox to do the work of the gospel in any way, shape, size, or form, to be totally clear on that. Before switching subjects, oh, isn't this touching? Sarcasm alert. LGBTQNation.com. Trans boy wins prom king title at Indianapolis High School. A transgender boy was named prom king of an Indianapolis high school this weekend. Alan Belmont, 17, came out as transgender during his sophomore year at North Central High School. Since then, he's faced some bullying, but he still wanted to run for prom king because he felt a surge of confidence this year. Belmont told WTHR, "They announced my name and the crowd cheered so loud it warmed my heart so much. The whole night was full of people cheering me on. So seeing that they voted for something so big was incredible." He says that he has encountered some ignorance. In one case, someone crossed out King in his Al Belmont for prom king flyer and wrote Queen. Belmont says that his friends promptly took it down. "I brush it off because I know my cause is greater than their ignorance and I don't want that to be the focus of my identity. After winning the title this weekend, I use this platform to send a message to others who are bullied at school. I want kids to know that confidence is the key to surviving bullying. If you love yourself, negative words mean nothing. If you know they aren't true, believe your own happiness and love over others' negativity and hate." All right, how do I respond to this? There are two or three things going on here in the school where a boy gets named prom king. And by the way, for the older generation who grew up with Bruce Jenner on boxes of Wheaties, and Bruce Jenner is the epitome of manliness. I mean, he won the decathlon, the ultimate event. There's not a women's decathlon. Women have less events because they're just not able to do everything that would go into a decathlon at that same level of excellence. And here the men have to perform all these different things. I mean, how do you train? You're the ultimate athlete. And in that sense, the ultimate male athlete, that's how we knew Bruce Jenner. So for us to know Bruce Jenner as Caitlyn Jenner is more jarring than for people who just knew him as some attachment to the Kardashian family or something like that. And yes, he is the father of the girls. And his ex-wife has expressed outrage with parts of the biography where he claims that she knew all along that he had these issues. And she said, "What are you talking about?" Now, who's telling the truth? I don't know. But they were married. He was attracted to her as a woman. They did have all these children together. So whatever struggles he was going through, obviously they did not totally define his life. But what do we make of the situation in the high school? I say several things are going on. On the one hand, kids are standing up for an underdog. I like that. Kids are standing up for another kid who got bullied. I like that. Kids are saying, "You mistreat him, we stand with him. You mistreat him, you empower him to be stronger, and we're going to stand with him." I like that. Siding with the underdog, siding with the victim, siding with the one who's bullied. I like that. Good. Okay. Now here are the two bad parts. Very bad. This is also part of young people pushing against the established norms. This is part of young people pushing back against what they perceive to be tradition. This is not tradition. This is biology. This is history. This is the human race. This is how God made us, male and female. So they are pushing back against the gender binary. It is the spirit of the age right now to be pushing back against this, to be fighting against it, to be fighting against gender distinctions, to be fighting against the order that God has established. And I have some quotes from young people in an NPR, a positive transgender NPR radio interview from a few years ago. We've played clips of it. I've often excerpted some of the quotes from it, where some of the young people say, "Yeah, we're pushing back against the established norms. This is the oppressive way of doing things and the oppressive way of the older generation. We're pushing back. This is some of the pushback." That's negative. That's unhelpful. The other is the direct result of gender confusion. The other is the direct result of this breaking down of gender distinctions from early ages, from the celebrating of homosexuality, celebrating bisexuality, so thereby challenging norms of sexual orientation and attraction. Now, launching a war against gender norms. So it's not just the war against the gender binary. It is also the confusion of what it means to be male, female, what it means to be husband, wife, what it means to be family, why boys are boys and girls are girls. All of this becomes increasingly confused, and the kids play into it. The celebration of I Am Kate, the celebration of transgender teen jazz, young people bombard it with this, and media and social media changes their thinking. This becomes the new norm. Hence, they cheer for something like this. It's a sign of the state of the times. We are changing to the subject of science, but there's going to be a little overlap. Stay with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
If you haven't read my latest article, go over to thelineoffire.org and click on our digital library. It's Low-Cut Top Sexual Harassment and Bill O'Reilly, getting a lot of comments on some other websites where it has been posted. All right. Changing subjects. Actually, at the bottom of the hour, 3:30 Eastern Standard Time, wherever time you are, where you're listening. But so just a few minutes from now, I'm going to bring on with me Dr. Douglas Axe. He is the director of the Biologic Institute and holds a PhD from Caltech. He's held postdoctoral and research scientist positions at the University of Cambridge and others. Yeah, pretty impressive resume here. We're going to have a fascinating discussion today about the science march. Was it a science march at all? Of course, this took place a few days ago. But first, one other subject I want to get into with you here. What's happening in the church today? What's happening in terms of Reformation movements? This is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. Many are saying the Reformation needs more reforming. There are Messianic Jewish friends who say the Reformation needs a major reformation in terms of its views on Israel, going back to Luther. There are others in the house church movement who say the Reformation has never repudiated the clergy-laity distinction. And there are others saying, no, we just need to go back to our traditions more. And what about the NAR, the New Apostolic Reformation? What do we make of that? I would find it very humorous if not for the fact that some people take this thing so seriously and then misreport and misinform. I would find it to be very humorous when people do this investigative journalism to prove that Dr. Michael Brown is actually part of the New Apostolic Reformation. And look, he's friends with leaders in the NAR. And he's done meetings with people in the NAR. And he believes that the gifts of the Spirit and the apostolic office and things like that are for today. Yeah, what's that got to do with me being a member of the New Apostolic Reformation? What have you discovered that's not totally public and known to all and stuff I've never denied whatsoever? No, I'm not part of the New Apostolic Reformation. That's a specific movement that was led by the late Dr. Peter Wagner, that had very specific beliefs, and I'm not part of that. I was never part of that. Never part of that organization. Never related to Peter Wagner, with all respect, as like a chief executive apostle kind of leader or something like that, or had the right to appoint apostles over other countries or things like that. I've never related to that or believed in that, with all respect to Dr. Wagner, and that many things he'd preach and teach that I would fully agree with. When this movement began to grow, I saw something positive in terms of people recognizing that apostolic ministry with a small a, not like the first 12, but with a small a, that has gone on in church history, and the more we recognize it, the better. And that apostolic and prophetic ministry continue to play important roles in the body today, along with evangelist and pastor and teacher, that I see these as ongoing based on Scripture, And based on my understanding spiritually of what God's doing in the world and the church today, taught that plainly and unashamedly for many years. But what I also saw was through some of the NAR teaching that everybody thought they were an apostle now. And that if you had more than one church, now you're an apostle. Or you're just going to change your title and now become apostle by acquisition, get other people to come under you, and now you're an apostle. Or apostles in the workplace and in the marketplace, as opposed to saying, hey, this person has a certain type of anointing and God uses them in the marketplace. No, now they're an apostle in the marketplace. So a lot of it I saw differently and didn't agree with, and therefore was never part of the movement. Do I believe that apostolic ministry is for today? Yeah, absolutely, totally. And there are people that believe that long before anyone ever heard of the New Apostolic Reformation, long before Dr. Wagner addressed the issues. Again, with all respect to Dr. Wagner, there's so much he wrote and did I deeply appreciate. I just never fully went for the NAR specific teachings and things like that, and was never part of that or submitted to that type of authority structure or viewpoint. There are friends of mine that I consider to be true apostles, and I understand them as sent by God with specific missions, part of the very meaning of the word, apostle, emissaries, sent by God, raised up for very specific purposes, often foundation-laying church, purposes, spiritual fathering purposes, to birth movements, to lead movements of churches and things like that. I see the anointing on them. God's backed them supernaturally. Some of them really been persecuted for the faith. Maybe the best-known ones on the earth are best known to God and not to us because they're laboring in obscurity. I would rather people don't put the title in front of their name. I just generally speaking, I think that's better. Paul wrote of himself as an apostle as opposed to calling himself the Apostle Paul. But even so, that's Paul. Fine. He's at a different level in terms of authority and how God used him in the church. But I rather we just don't even put a ministry title in front of us. I'm Evangelist Mike Brown. I'm Pastor Mike Brown. I'm Apostle Mike Brown. I'm Prophet Mike Brown. I'd rather we don't even do that in general. But that's an aside. So do I believe that there are apostles alive today? Sure, absolutely. Like my friend Yesu Padam in India. I don't think he'd ever call himself that, but yeah, I believe that he absolutely is a modern-day apostle. No question. I've used him as an example many times. So do I believe in apostolic ministry today? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Am I friends with people who've been long-term friends and co-workers of Peter Wagner who were part, identifiable frontline parts of the NAR? Yeah, sure. Friends, co-workers, absolutely. A number of them, absolutely. Worked together for years. But I was never part of that movement. And I don't identify with that movement, nor did I embrace all the ideology of the movement or the specific time frames in which God allegedly did X, Y, Z. So there's no duplicity.
He says he's not part of it, but he is.
If I was, I'd say so. I'm not ashamed of it. There's a lot that I agree with and other parts I disagree with, but I was never formally part of it or formally under it or submitted to it in any way, shape, size, or form. Simple. So you can write all the articles and post all the videos and have all the websites.
Dr. Brown, he denies it, but
not true, not true. Why don't you focus on what I do believe? How's that? And agree with that or disagree with that instead of fighting shadows. Actually, I'm going to reveal this. Maybe I shouldn't. Johnny, maybe I shouldn't, but I'm going to. I'm actually a secret member of the Knights of the Round Table. And I've been ordained to the knighthood by Sir Arthur himself, who's still alive. Yeah, and you heard it first, right here on the Line of Fire. Okay, that's as real as me being a card-carrying member of the NAR. We'll be right back with Dr. Douglas Axe.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
There was a recent march. This was supposed to be a science march, a celebration of science. But there are scientists who are saying it was anything but that. And I was also sent a link yesterday. Absolutely, absolutely mind-boggling. It was Bill Nye, who calls himself the science guy. And it was some, I don't know what you call it, skit performance about transgender. It was so vulgar. It was so perverse. And this is now supposedly got to do with science, just pushing some ideological agenda. So how do those of us who are not scientists sort these things out? This global warming and those kinds of things. I'm speaking with Dr. Douglas Axe, the director of the Biologic Institute. His research uses both experiments and computer simulations to examine the functional and structural constraints on the evolution of proteins and protein systems, a PhD in Caltech, and he has taught at institutions in Cambridge University, and others. And his work and ideas have been featured in many scientific journals and works with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Axe, it's a joy to have you on the air. Thanks so much for joining us.
Ah, it's great to be here.
Now, what's your take just in general, sir, on this March for Science and what it's supposedly about? We're told that the reason for this is it's a protest against the anti-science platform of Donald Trump and his administration. From your viewpoint, what's actually going on here?
Well, this if you research the history of it, the idea got kicked off in January with some people grumbling about the Trump administration approach to climate change policy, and it snowballed from there. And a number of other issues for, activism attached themselves to the march because they figured if a bunch of people are descending on D.C., we want to be a part of it. And it became a very diffuse and confused thing where people with all kinds of complaints wanted to attach themselves to the March for Science and be a part of it. But at the end of the day, although activism certainly has its place and scientists can be activists, no one would claim otherwise, it's really important for people who respect science to distinguish activism as an activity, a legitimate one, from science as a very different activity, because science really has to hold the truth as being paramount, and it has to recognize with humility that any one person in pursuit of the truth might not get it right, and therefore it's important to listen to other people who disagree. Debate is at the very center of what science is about, and so I'm very suspicious when I see something that looks like a protest and something that's denouncing people who think one way and then justifying this denouncement in the name of science, because it shows real confusion as to how science really works.
So when we're seeing, for example, Bill Nye debating someone with the Trump administration about global warming, and then we're told, well, all science agrees, or this is just a no discussion, no debate issue, it's the case closed. Is that accurate? The scientific consensus has shifted and there's no debate on this anymore? Or is this kind of the strong-arming thing that you're talking about, saying we're going to use protest and force and numbers to silence dissenting views?
It's clearly a mistake to think that a majority view has to be correct. In the sciences, that is just historically not true. You can look at case after case where the vast majority of scientists in a particular field thought it was one way, and it turns out to be another way. So we're being naive if we think that today it's different, and today if all the scientists agree, then it has to be true. And the truth is, although we're talking about consensus here, we're talking really about a majority opinion, where the minority in the case of climate change is about a 10% minority by some guesses, which is a significant, or by some measures, which is a significant minority. Hundreds of experts who disagree with the consensus view on climate change.
I tell you what, we're going to jump in right here. We'll be right back. Dr. Axe wrote The March That Trampled Science.
It's fire we want, for fire we please. Stand in the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest, scientist, Dr. Douglas Axe, the director of Biologic Institute. His recent article, The March That Trampled Science. The march was never about science. It's about political activism masquerading as science. Dr. Axe, here's what happens to us as we're watching, whether it's Bill Nye, whether it was Carl Sagan in a past generation, or whoever the latest spokesperson is, or Richard Dawkins. I've got a PhD in Semitic languages, but when it comes to science, I'm got a black hole in terms of my science knowledge. So somebody gets on TV, and they're talking with authority, and they have all this education, and they know better than the rest of us. It can be very intimidating. And when it gets joined to political activism, and now science is going to be speaking outside of its sphere of authority, that's where it can really do damage. So what can science say and not say? Can science make a judgment about whether a sunset is beautiful, or can science make a judgment about what constitutes love, or can science weigh in on theology? What can science do and not do?
Clearly, yeah, clearly not. All these big things that matter most to us, really, science can't speak to them. Science can tell us how things work in the material realm, so that science can tell us how the planets were made, conceivably, but even there, it has to do that with some humility, saying no scientist actually observed things that happened a long time ago, but we can have models for how things work. And scientists, of course, can study how things work in the present, how plants photosynthesize, how various things happen in geology. But it can't weigh in on the purpose behind these things, or certainly it can't weigh in on the deeper aspects of human existence, our emotions, why we are the way we are, why were we intended in the first place, and where we're going. These are things where science has to be humbly mute. But regrettably, as you've mentioned, a number of scientists or people who associated with science aren't always mute. And people like Bill Nye, who aren't even really credentialed as scientists, will happily speak to all these things and tell us what the purpose of us being here is and how we got here and where we're going.
I saw a debate one time, Professor John Lennox versus Professor Richard Dawkins. And in Professor Dawkins' opening comments, he made some statement to the effect that vicarious atonement is unscientific. And I thought there's nothing about vicarious atonement that intersects with science, not one aspect of it. Human guilt for sin, or the idea of a substitutionary sacrifice being made that is acceptable to God, none of that intersects with science. And yet statements were made like that. So at the so-called March for Science, You have a guy identifying as a transgender queer man, and he's there as part of the March for Science. What's that got to do with the March for Science?
It's a good question. I mean, if you look at the website, they were touting diversity as being important for science, and I agree that it is, but perhaps the most significant or most central to what science is, form of diversity, is diversity of viewpoint, diversity of interpretation. And interestingly, while the March was seemingly promoting all these other kinds of diversity, it seems to have lost track of that one, the one that's really at the center of how you do science, which is allowing people with diverse opinions to be examining the data and debating one another as to what the data, how the data should be interpreted.
So let's take something as fundamental as Darwinian evolution and something that you would imagine has been debated and discussed with candor for many decades now. Is there freedom in academia, freedom in higher institutions? Is there freedom to dispute fundamental aspects of Darwinian evolution? Is there genuinely oppression or suppression of free speech here? Or is anything fair game? You want to question this, that, go for it. Or are there things that are sacred cows you dare not touch?
Certainly, and my own experience shows this, you will pay a price if you're in the life sciences and you question Darwinism, if you question it deeply. So calling into question the claim that we are the product of accidental material causes, that will get you in trouble. Of course, you can do a minor critique of Darwinism and say there's something other than natural selection that's shaping life. But once you challenge the main philosophy that Darwinism is a cornerstone to, then you get yourself into trouble. You're not allowed to do that. And in all cases, no one says we are in favor of censorship. We're trying to close down the debate. They always say there is no debate here. This is absolute truth. So the fact that you're questioning this shows that you're crazy, and that's why we're trying to shut you down. But you know, that's a ploy. That has always been a ploy for closing down debate, saying the other side doesn't deserve to be heard, therefore we're shutting them down.
Right. So when I'll interact with folks about, say, social issues, and they'll call me, they'll treat me with scorn and nasty on every level, name-calling, dismissing of every factual bit of information I give them. And then when I tell them they're acting in an intolerant way, they tell me that they don't tolerate bigots. So there's always an excuse for the shutting the door. So yeah, we don't teach the tooth fairy either in our schools. But questioning Darwinism is not like advancing the idea of a tooth fairy. There are massive holes and issues. So what makes the scientific establishment stand on these things? Is it money? Is it we're right? Is it pride?
I wrote a book called Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. And part of the book, a good part of the book, the front part, several chapters, I'm telling a story of my own experience of how I was removed from a position in Cambridge, England, over the controversy over Darwinism. And I'm trying to show people that science is as human as every other enterprise. And somehow we think it's going to rise above that. Somehow we think that the scientific method will rid science of all the frailty and faults of humanity, but they're all there. And the scientific method doesn't in any way diminish that. There's politics, there's egos, there's selfish behavior, there's groupthink, all of those things that taint every other human endeavor, they're there in the sciences.
All right, so people are people.
In other words. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. Look, for years I just naively thought that, say, doctors and the whole medical industry and pharmaceutical industry had only altruistic motivation because doctors want to save lives and help people. Now, of course, doctors work hard to do that very thing, but then you got money, you got big business.
Right.
And if some drug is going to now put another company out of business, it may not get introduced for that very reason. And as far as what science can and can't do, this was tweeted out here. Let me just scroll up. This was from, the Science March DC Twitter account. And it's said this: colonization, racism, immigration, native rights, sexism, ableism, queer, trans, intersex phobia, and economic justice are scientific issues. And here you are laboring as a scientist with the Biologic Institute. How do you feel when you hear this type of tweet?
Well, and that's the famous one that got deleted afterward, I think. That was one of those early ones. I think I know where they're coming from. They're saying, I'm part of a community of scientists, and these are the things that matter to me, therefore they're scientific issues. But we have to be really clear with our language. You can say, as a scientist, I'm concerned about these things, and I have a lot of friends who are scientists who are concerned about these things. But be careful not to call that science, because science has to be something that is open, that does not... Everyone is allowed to come to the table to dialogue over science. It's based on observable data, but nobody beats up on anyone else. We all go to the data and we try to interpret it, and we have to be open to criticism of our view. And at the end of the day, you win that kind of debate by convincing, not by cutting people off the debate, not by protesting, not by rallying in Washington, D.C.
And one of your goals is to get people to think for themselves, correct?
Correct. And if you go to the March website, they say the same thing. So they kind of contradict themselves on that.
Right. If you're saying think for yourself, then you're not screaming and yelling at the opposition, nor are you trying to intimidate the opposition with numbers. and things like that. Hey, I've just got a couple more questions for you. I know your time is precious, but on the other side of the break, let's just ask a few basic biological questions that tie in with Dr. Axe's book, Undeniable. And then, really quickly, just a few reasons why experts are not all in on human-based climate change, why there can be scientific reasons for the questions as opposed to just people sticking their head in the sand and denying reality. Dr. Axe is saying, let us not deny what is undeniable. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Join us on The Line of Fire today. I'm speaking with scientist Dr. Douglas Axe. He is the director of the Biologic Institute and author of the book Undeniable, which focuses on issues of biology that challenge Darwinian evolution. So, Dr. Axe, let's say you were speaking to college, university students in a secular environment, and they've drunk the Kool-Aid of Darwinism. That's all they've known is science. If you were going to raise questions for them, if you only had a half hour to raise questions to make them think and wonder if their system really works, what type of questions would you put forth for them?
Good question. I do this in my half hour talks is I go back to the same thing that I started the book with, which is the fact that there is an intuition that everyone has, and this is widely acknowledged. I call it the universal design intuition, that when we're preschool age, 3 or 4 years old, and we're looking at living things, we automatically intuit that they were made by a godlike designer. This is widely acknowledged. And of course, many of the people who are acknowledging this are saying that's a wrong intuition and therefore we need to educate it out of 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds. But I think it's very interesting that it exists, that it's widely acknowledged, and that it's universal. So I start my talks with that intuition, say we all have it. Many of us have been educated to think that it's false and that Darwin got it right, that our intuition is wrong. But even career biologists, Francis Crick said, biologists must constantly remind themselves that what they're studying was not designed, but rather evolved. So even after a whole career of trying to suppress this intuition, we have to keep suppressing it because it keeps cropping up. So that doesn't prove anything, but I start with that intuition because it's a way to it's a common ground that we can all say, oh, that's interesting that we all think that way. And then what I do in half an hour is show how in a very sort of common sense way, if we examine the way that intuition works, it turns out to have scientific content to it, that it's actually correct. I use an origami crane as an illustration. I use it in the book too. If a 4-year-old came across this folded origami crane on a table, didn't see where it came from, they would know immediately, automatically, that someone made that, because they look at that sort of thing and they say, that's a piece of paper, but someone did something clever to it. How would I make that? And it's the same sort of intuition that we have when we look at plants and animals, butterflies.
Yeah, and again, the whole intelligent design argument, and if you, say, came down in the morning and your alphabet cereal was lined up with a message, you know, a specific message, you'd know somebody lined it up. And, you know, the Christopher Hitchens response was, it would probably just say, oh, well, that's not the case. It's meet me at this time. I'll see you there. Sorry, I didn't have a pen. All I could do is write with the cereal. You knew someone did it. It's not that the box just fell open. So the more you study and the more you learn as a scientist, the more it becomes almost impossible to deny design, logically, rationally. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. That's what I mean by the title Undeniable. This intuition, you can challenge it and examine it critically, and you find that in the end it is undeniable. It's correct.
Yeah, again, the book Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. By the way, what's interesting is that the reviews on Amazon are overwhelmingly positive, because normally when the moment you touch on these things, you're going to get a lot of naysayers that weigh in. But you must be presenting things in such a way that people are saying, yeah, it's kind of undeniable.
Yeah, it's been good to see how the reviews a lot of readers really get the argument, and they find it to be a helpful argument. So,
yeah, and you know what's interesting, again, as a non-scientist, my own suspicion is the more science learns, the harder it's going to be to deny some type of intelligent design. You know, the whole DNA thing, and then it's junk DNA, or it's actually not junk DNA, and it becomes more amazing to me, again, just as someone with limited scientific knowledge. All right, very quickly, just 3 minutes. So Bill Nye, the science guy, is not a credentialed scientist, number one. But number two, his idea that it is known, it is factual, scientific, uniform consensus, aside from the crazies denying it, man-made global warming is an issue. You say at least 10% or roughly 10% of experts would question that. What are the fundamental things that they are questioning scientifically?
Well, I mean, the big issue is not, I think what's not being questioned is that climate does change. Everyone
right.
agrees on that. The question is, has human activity, specifically greenhouse gases that we're producing by burning hydrocarbons, has that caused substantial climate change? And I don't know what I have a paper in front of me called Scientists' Views About Attribution of Global Warming, where it says, you know, they did a study and they surveyed hundreds of these scientists, and among them were 218 that were tagged as being unconvinced of the evidence. So these are experts who've published on climate change, and hundreds of them are not convinced that the consensus view is right. Now, of course, there's a larger number that is convinced, or it wouldn't be a consensus. One of the things that has to be weighing in here, and I don't know what's correct on this because it's not my area, but I do know that you can't do an experiment on climate change the way you can do an experiment in a test tube. You can't have a control planet Earth that goes one way and then an experimental planet Earth that goes another way. There's only one planet Earth, and we can't rerun history to see what would have been different had we not used fossil fuels, for example. So it's intrinsically difficult to get a scientific answer with that kind of question. You have to use models, you use mathematical models. They're always complicated. There's always assumptions that go into them. And you're never going to be absolutely confident that you've got it right.
Got it. Yeah, well, that is helpful. And again, it just reminds us of the humility with which people need to approach these subjects. When we talk about the established results of science, I think what was considered established 100 years ago, how much of that is affirmed today? So as a scientist, you speak with certitude when you can, and other times you speak of theses and hypotheses and things like that. But then again, certain things are undeniable, as you say in your book. So I appreciate your voice. What can folks learn from the Discovery Institute? I know you're a colleague with the Institute there.
Well, the evolution and intelligent design debate is probably the biggest thing that's happening at Discovery, but they're doing other things in terms of economic policy as well. So there's a lot going on at Discovery. And I'm directing Biologic Institute, which is kind of a sister organization that was set up to bring together scientists all over the world and allow them to work together to do work from an intelligent design perspective without having bricks thrown at them, hopefully.
Incredible. And where can folks find out more about this?
For Discovery, it's discovery.org. For Biologic Institute, it's biologicinstitute.org. For my book, it's undeniabledesign.com.
Excellent. All right. Hey, thank you so much for giving so much of your time today and enlightening us and helping us. And you've got me interested in your book. Somehow I'd missed it, but man, that looks like a fascinating read. Undeniable by Dr. Douglas Axe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, friends, that's it. We are out of time, but check out my latest articles and videos at thelineoffire.org. While you're there, be sure to sign up for my e-newsletter. I want to send you a free ebook when you do.